down. Just for people that want to do Mari, we're going to try to get it going. So many of you have heard Rabbi Ari Kahn. He is one of my favorite speakers, so I'm like a groupie. Rabbi Ari Kahn, he's got a lot of titles behind him. He's the vice president of Migdal Or, which is the reason he's actually here right now. He's also the director of foreign student programs and a senior lecturer at Bar Ilan in Israel. And he's a senior educator at Eish Jerusalem. I also want to note that he has a couple of fabulous books. We read them almost every Shabbos. One is called Explorations, and the other one's Emanations. And he is now working on a five-volume series. The first one, Bereshis, will be out. It's called Echoes of Eden. And when do you think it's going to be out? Next couple of months, so look for that. So tonight, very interesting topic. Have the rabbis ruined Judaism? What is the nature and scope of the power of the rabbis? So I want to just introduce Rabbi Kahn.
It's okay, they'll be asleep very soon. So listen, if you wanted a short answer to that question, the rabbis ruined Judaism, I guess it would either be yes or no. But they may also have saved it. But let's try to understand this topic properly. I know for a lot of people, the answer to that question would be yes. For other people, the answer would be absolutely no. And for some people, I think in their minds, there's such a thing as good rabbis and bad rabbis. And who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, that may be the argument. Now, this week I was teaching a class, and I had a very specific point that I wanted to make. I teach a class in Contemporary Issues in Jewish Law in Bar Ilan University, and I had spoken about the topic of abortion in the last couple of weeks. I don't want to get into it more than necessary right now, but you may or may not be surprised to find out that in terms of the topic of abortion, there's a huge range of opinions, and probably much more than you would ever imagine. And one of the people who strict, incredibly strict, was Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. He was strict to the point that he felt that abortion is murder. Black and white is murder. He felt the only thing that can possibly justify it would be if the fetus is threatening the mother's life. No other possible justification. So I'm speaking to an audience of people who are either modern Orthodox or almost modern Orthodox or thinking of being modern Orthodox or maybe not necessarily. And most of these people are raised within a society where we believe to a very great extent in personal autonomy, in our ability to make choices. And here for a rabbi to get up and say that, no, this is not allowed, I think they saw him as being one of the bad rabbis. Right? And then I taught a class yesterday. Was this really yesterday? Yes, this really was yesterday. Today is Thursday, right? So I taught a class yesterday in Israel, and the class was one particular case that had come up, unfortunately, around 30 years ago, maybe a bit more even, 30, 40 years ago. It was a case of co-joined twins, or what's commonly called Siamese twins, who were born to a religious, actually an ultra-Orthodox family. And Rav Moshe Feinstein was the one who had to decide on that case. And Rav Moshe Feinstein allowed them to separate the twins, even though separation would mean that one of them would die. Now, it could be that for everybody in this room, that's obvious. You don't need a rabbi to come and tell you, actually, it wasn't obvious to everyone. Because what gives you the right to kill one baby to save another baby? Are we allowed to play God and so on? By the way, the doctor who was the chief surgeon of the hospital, which was Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, was a man named C. Everett Koop, which some of you may remember. And C. Everett Koop, actually, when he was pressed by his staff saying, we need to do something, he responded, but I don't know what to do. And he said, but there's a rabbi, an elderly man, who's a very wise man, a very saintly man. He lives in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And when he figures out what to do, then I'll know what to do as well. Okay, so again, just very interesting perspective. But what I wanted to show my students was something else, was that it was only because of Moshe Feinstein was so stringent in terms of his attitude towards abortion is what allowed him to allow this separation to take place. And again, I don't want to just tell you the whole argument, but I'll just a little bit, so you can, again, appreciate just the point. Rav Moshe basically set up an analogy and said that the twin, they were sharing a heart. One twin had a heart, which was functioning. One twin had a kidney, the same one. One twin had a liver, the same one. The other one didn't have all of those things. So Rav Moshe said that the relationship of baby A to baby B is the same relationship as a fetus to a mother. But other people who think a fetus is not on the same level as a real life could not have made that analogy. It was only because Rav Moshe was so strict in terms of abortion that allowed him to be able to separate these twins in this case. So what I wanted them to appreciate in this is not a question of he's a good guy and he's a bad guy. It's a question that there's a law, and he came to his decision based upon very serious analysis. And when you take law, there are going to be all kinds of ramifications that you may not anticipate. When you try to change law, you can have all kinds of ramifications. And I'll come back and I'll explain this in a moment. Actually, somebody walked into my room, into the classroom, in the middle of my speaking, and he looked remarkably like a rabbi. I think you've seen the type before. And, I mean, people tend to walk in my room. I don't know why. Apparently, somebody must be sending them. I don't know. So he walked in, and I looked at him. And again, I have two choices at that point. One is just to ignore that a male who looks definitely like a rabbi is coming into an all-woman's class. So it could be a woman in a terrible disguise. Or it could be a rabbi in terrible dress, which, as I'm saying, this is a rabbi, special clothing. Anyway, I looked at him and I said, who are you? So he told me, I'm Rabbi so-and-so. I said, wonderful, please take a seat, whatever. I said, why are you here? So he told me that somebody asked him to come and listen. So I said, wonderful, you're welcome. And then I looked at him and I said, are you a good rabbi or a bad rabbi? And obviously, being very culturally educated, he understood the reference immediately, yeah, to the Wizard of Oz. And he said, I'm a good rabbi. He said, okay. So welcome. But we tend to do that. We tend to look and say that, you know, these people are too strict and these people are too lenient. I mean, again, just going to that same point, the rabbi who actually was more lenient than anybody else in the 20th century on abortion. And I say rabbi, I'm talking about Orthodox rabbi with a long coat and the whole getup was Rabbi Waldenberg. And then I said to my students, I said, let me ask you a question. You've seen that Rav Moshe thinks it's murder and Rav Waldenberg essentially thinks it's allowed, I'll say, even in a case to prevent embarrassment of the mother, which is as extreme as you can possibly imagine. And I said, what do you think will be their relative opinions regarding plastic surgery? Well, this is easy. Because if Rav Moshe thinks that abortion is not allowed, so then maybe he doesn't believe in personal autonomy, and he doesn't believe you can make a choice on such a thing, and he won't think that plastic surgery is allowed. And if Rabbi Waldenberg believes that you are allowed to have an abortion, then he's certainly going to say that you can have plastic surgery. Guess what? It's the other way around. Reverend Waldenberg says, absolutely, plastic surgery is not allowed unless there is a real medical indication for it. And Rabbi Feinstein felt that if somebody feels embarrassed or uncomfortable the way that they look, they're allowed to have plastic surgery. Again, almost the opposite, but again, it's not a question of he's good and he's bad. Halacha is far more complex than that.
Just a point of clarification. By abortion, do you mean after the fetus is viable or at any time?
I mean even after the fetus is viable.
Well, do you mean before the fetus is viable?
No, I said even after the fetus.
No, before.
That's easier. Before. I'm saying Rav Oldenburg allowed it even after. So I'm saying that's even easier. Here, think about the following. A number of years ago, I was invited to do something that I don't like to do. And it was speaking publicly, and I know that you're thinking, do I really not like to do that? But no, that wasn't the whole thing. It was speaking publicly in an area or an arena that I had no interest in going. It was held in Tel Aviv University, and there was going to be a panel discussion / debate going on between a representative of secular Judaism, a representative of Reform Judaism, a representative of conservative Judaism, and a friend of mine agreed to become the representative of Orthodoxy. The fellow went and had himself a stroke, ended up in the hospital. His wife called me up from his bed saying, he's supposed to go in 2 days and represent Orthodoxy. Will you go? So now, what can I say in such a case to her? Absolutely not. Throw him out of bed. Tell him to go. So I was stuck. You guys didn't know that I represented many of you. So I heard them get up, and they all said essentially the same thing. The Reform, the secular fellow got up and said that, you know, Judaism is a very good culture and so on and so forth, a very good history, but we need to make changes, we need to keep it up, make it up to date. It's become fossilized. That was the word. I thought I was in a convention of paleontologists, by the way. I heard the word fossilization so many times that evening, so I thought I was in the wrong place. And every one of them are telling us how we have to update things and change things and so on and so forth. So when I finally had my opportunity to speak, I won't give the whole speech, but I will make one point that I made. I said a number of years ago, and this is close to 50 years ago, the conservative movement decided to allow people to drive to shul on Shabbos. Now, was this a good decision or was this a bad decision? Is this something which could be based upon Jewish law, or is this just absolutely against Jewish law? So I'll tell you right now. There are reasons that you could allow somebody to break Shabbos, you with me? To save someone's life spiritually. Not just to save somebody's life physically. And this is written in the Shulchan Aruch. In the Shulchan Aruch it says you're allowed to break Shabbos, you encourage somebody to break Shabbos in order to have a chance of saving somebody's life spiritually. By the way, does that mean that every Shabbos morning I should now get in my car, go off to the beach in Tel Aviv, and see if there's anybody there that looks like they need saving? Not necessarily. On the other hand, let's say a student of mine calls me and says, that's it, I'm leaving yeshiva, I've had enough, I'm going to go back to L.A. to a place which is decadent and so on and so forth, and I can speak to them before they leave, and I get the call Friday afternoon at 5 minutes before Shabbos. So I can assure you that, again, if it was a little more extreme than the way that I just now described it, instead of coming to L.A., I'll make it easy for you, they're going to go join an ashram someplace. I can assure you right now that if you called Rav Yoshev on the phone and asked him, should I get in the car and try to stop him, he would say yes. Matter of fact, I could tell you something that you're not going to believe me. So I'll say it, but afterwards you'll tell me you don't believe me. No, afterwards. It's too soon. You know, if you want to do this properly, you need timing. Without timing, this is not going to work, okay? In 1982, Israel was at war. I know you can pick almost any year. We were at war. We were at war in Lebanon. In those days, they didn't have cell phones. And by the way, two of my sons served in combat units in the Israeli army, and both of them, when they did a stint up north near the Lebanese border, came back and said, you don't know how frightening it is. Not because that they're so brave, in terms of the technology that they have. During the more recent Lebanese war, they went in and they found houses there with the names of all the Israeli soldiers in the units that were stationed up north, the names of their wives, the names of their children, the names of anything else that they may have said while they were on their cell phones. Because they were listening and monitoring all the calls and they had all the information over there. Just something to be absolutely frightened about. In 1982, we didn't have cell phones. In 1980, at least we didn't have cell phones. In 1982, the people that were up in Lebanon had no ability to contact their parents for weeks upon weeks upon weeks. On one beautiful Shabbos morning, an army telephone, you know these things that you crank up? An army telephone made its way to Lebanon. And they were able to use them. One of the soldiers who was religious said, I wonder if I'm allowed to call my parents. I'm sure that they're worrying sick about me. And another one said, no, you couldn't call. Another one says, well, I think you could call. So one of the guys says, I know what to do. I'll call Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach up and ask him if we're allowed to call our parents. One second. Do any of you appreciate the irony right now? So they decided that's what they're going to do. If you want, names could be provided to verify this story. So they called up Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Guess what? He answered the phone. And he says, what's the matter? And the guy told him the situation. He said, tell everybody to call their parents. Tell everyone to call their parents on Shabbos because they're worried sick about you. By the way, any of you who don't call your parents know when they're worried about you, now you realize what Shlomo Zalman said, in such a situation, even you can do it on Shabbos. Again, and I don't want you to extrapolate from this for every Shabbos morning to call your parents. But now you understand the significance of making your parents worry about you. Can I continue the story? One of these fellows then went after the war to Rav Shlomo Zalman. And he said, I have one question for you. And he said, what's that? He said, why do you answer the phone on Shabbos? So he said, well, who do you think calls me on Shabbos? It's only in emergencies. So if somebody's going to call me, he said, I know it's a life and death situation. That's why they're calling me. Isn't it interesting how these modern Orthodox rabbis behave? You're going to write this now? You put this on your web? But let me get back to when I was representing all of you. So I said, the conservative movement made a decision to allow across the board, not an emergency situation, not where somebody's parents are worried sick about them, every Shabbos you can get in your car and drive to shul. Now again, I could debate the halach of this point. I'm going to pause again. I had a student a number of years ago, and she was the most wonderful young woman. She was brought up in the conservative movement. And she was brought up with such respect and such love of God and love of mitzvot. And she wanted to do the right thing. She used to put tefillin on every day. All of the men here who don't put on tefillin every day, be embarrassed. I know you're going to say, but she doesn't have a yetzahara not to, and that's why she does. It means you spend too much time in yeshiva. So when she came to Israel, she had been told that putting on tefillin is not necessary for a girl, but for a boy it is necessary. So you know what she did? She took her tefillin, she gave it to her brother, and said, you need to put this on every day. And she never put it on again. During the time that she had studied with me, she became more and more observant. And it was around Pesach time, she came into my office, she said, I need to speak to you. And by the way, I had spoken to her parents, I had met her parents, wonderful, wonderful people. They were nice, conservative Jews. Wonderful people. She said, I'm going home for Passover, and my parents are going to make everything kosher in a way which is good for me, in a way that I can eat. And I said, so what's the matter? She said, one thing bothers me. They're going to expect me to go to their shul, which is a conservative shul, and they drive there. I said, is there a possibility of walking? She said, no, we live too far. So I will right now admit to you in public, if there wasn't a tape going, I would deny it. Maybe I'll pause this part now. I will admit to you in public that I spoke to her, and knowing the case, knowing the individual, I told her, on this trip, not subsequent trips, on this trip, this is what I want you to do. I want you to go to your parents and tell them that you'll go to them with you'll go with them to shul, but ask them, instead of them driving, that they're going to order a cab, somebody who's not Jewish, pay him before, and have the cab driver go with you, drive and take you. I said, this is not an across-the-board heter. I'm telling you, for this, for you, for your parents, knowing them for this time, this is, because I don't want things to blow up. They respect you, you respect them. This is the right thing in this particular case. By the way, the irony of this is the last time I told this story, I was walking with somebody. I was speaking in Boston around 6 months ago. Persian fellow from L.A., actually. I was walking with him in the streets of Boston, walking to shul, and something happened. I told him this story, and I said, but you know what happened? When she got there and she told her parents this, and they say, no, we respect you. We don't want you to get in the car with us. We don't want you to drive with us. We don't expect you to do that. And again, because there was respect on one side, respect on the other side, and it never happened that she had to get in the car. So then he asked, and what happened with her? I said, she became a firm girl. And I said, I'm thinking, you know what, maybe she lives in Boston. 2 minutes later, I'd see her and her mother walking together, going to shul on Shabbos. Orthodox shul, and she was wearing a shetel and the whole thing. Literally 2 minutes later. So again, I understand there are cases that you can allow people to drive to shul. What would I say? It's an extreme case. Correct? It's an extreme case. I'm not going to allow everybody. It's not across the board. And even the one time I allowed it, you heard the conditions that I set up. The conservative movement said that everybody can drive to shul. So now, what was supposed to be accomplished by this? And this is very simple. What was supposed to happen is that everyone's going to go to shul. Now, how many of you were brought up in conservative homes? Okay? How many people follow the conservative dictum that you only drove to shul on Shabbos and no place else? 1 second. Anybody here followed what the conservative actually said? Only drive to shul, no place else. How many of you, on the average Saturday, and I use that word very carefully, drove any place other than shul? Okay, so apparently it didn't work all that well. But that's not what bothers me. That's not what bothers me. What bothers me is something else completely. If you tell people that you can drive to shul on Shabbos, what else are you telling them? You're telling them that you don't have to live near a shul. And once you get in a car, does it really make a difference if it's a 6 minute drive or a 16 minute drive? It doesn't make that much of a difference. So if you don't live near a shul, where are your kids going to go to school? The further you live from the shul, the less likely they are going to go to a school in a Jewish community. So therefore, by allowing people to drive to shul on Shabbos, what you're actually doing is causing assimilation and intermarriage. You can imagine how well I was received in that audience over there. I said, it's great to make changes. But if you make changes and you don't understand the larger system, you don't understand that when you fix something over here, what the implication is in a different area. And by the way, I stand by that. I stand by that. What the conservative movement did is they destroyed Jewish communities. Because there was no longer a sense of communities, and that's what we had for so many years. We had communities. If you can drive to shul, you don't need a community anymore. And everything else then follows afterwards. So, I guess the question then is, am I a good rabbi or a bad rabbi? That's a machlokes. I don't think it's significant, because you know why? I'm sure that all rabbis think they're good rabbis, right? Let me ask this. How many of you are good people? How many of you are bad people? Is it more likely that Mother Teresa thought that she was good or thought she was bad? And is it more likely that Hitler thought he was good or thought he was bad? So what we think about ourselves is probably not all that significant, and I hope you follow that line of reasoning. I think most rabbis think they're good people. I think they're doing a good job, and they're trying to do their best. I understand that, and I appreciate that. We as the Jewish community, need to take responsibility for our rabbis. And I will explain exactly what I mean by this. But let me go back a step or two earlier. We believe that our religion is divine. And if it's divine, then everything should be perfect. Because there's God, who's ultimately the chairman of the board. God is the one who's ultimately in charge. So if God's the one who's in charge, and anything happens which is not divine, we get ourselves very, very frustrated. And if the title over here, which is not the title that I wanted, but they said I need a better title, else no one's going to come. I don't know. But now I have nothing to say. Is when people say, have rabbis ruined Judaism, so what are we saying? That God created a religion which is good, and somebody's messed it up along the way. Why? Because within this formulation, there's an understanding that there's something which is inherently divine and inherently holy, and somehow we messed it up. So now, again, I just want you to think about this, to consider this. God made a strategic decision, and that strategic decision was to take in a partner. Any of you have businesses? If you have a business, you take in a partner. Do you now bear all responsibility for what your partner is going to do? Yes. Yes. Because you took in the partner. God took a partner. Who's God's partner? We are. Which means the second that God takes humans as his junior partner, God has responsibility for this. But now we realize that something which should be divine, or completely divine, is not necessarily going to be completely divine because there's a human element to it. Now, is that part of the plan? Of course it's part of the plan. Because when God took this divine stuff called Torah, handed it to man, you are my partner in this, it's now going to have a human element to it. And humans, may I point out, mess up consistently. So yes, there's a human element to Judaism, there's a human element to Torah. We, as Jews, are not infallible. We, as rabbis, are not infallible. We make mistakes. We do things which are wrong. But we also have a senior partner who trusts in us and gives us the right to make these decisions and calls upon us to get involved and to make Judaism work. Now, let's just imagine for a second that we had Judaism with no rabbinic law. Let's get rid of all the rabbinic law. So some of you would say, wow, that would be much better. The rabbis messed this up. Well, let's start with Shabbos, for example. Can you imagine Shabbos without any rabbinic law? And do you know what that would look like? And by the way, there was an experiment done on this, not on purpose. What are you shaking your head? You know which experiment? No, not the Karaites. What?
Sadducees.
Not the Sadducees. A different experiment. Orthodox Jews did an experiment on this, but not by choice. There's a place called Kobe, Japan. There were Jews who were stuck there during World War II. What's real interesting about Kobe, Japan, is it may or may not, now you can say machlokas again, it may or may not stand right by the international dateline in terms of halacha. Which means you all know there's a thing called the international dateline. What you don't know is that many rabbis don't trust it at all. Just to help you on this point, the international dateline that we have today in the world, which is used, makes one assumption. And that assumption is that Greenwich, England is the center of the world. Do any of you believe that Greenwich, England is the center of the world? Okay, if you don't believe that Greenwich is the center of the world, you may have a problem with the dateline where it currently is. Many rabbis have that problem as well. The place where the Jews were in Kobe was actually a difference of opinion whether it's Shabbos or whether it's Sunday. So you know what they did? They kept 2 days Shabbos every week. But on one of the days, Saturday, they kept it completely Torah law and rabbinic law. The second day, they only kept Torah law. And by the way, in case you want to know something else about this, These same people had a chance of getting out of Japan in 1941, but they did a calculation and they realized that they would be crossing the other international date line right around Yom Kippur, so they decided to not get on that boat and wait for the next boat. Unfortunately, December 1941 took place, and those of you who are too young to remember, or history doesn't interest you all that much, a war broke out at that point. It's something called Pearl Harbor. Happened during that time, and they were stuck for the next four years. They were stuck because they did not get on the boat at that point, because they were concerned with the international dateline. But they kept Shabbos the second day. So what happens on the second day of Shabbos where you only keep Torah law, no rabbinic law? What are you allowed to do? Well, first of all, take all of muksa, which is very annoying. Get rid of muksa. No more muksa. What else do you get rid of? Yeah, we can start debating driving, getting in a car, whatever. Can you open your store? Which rabbi said you can't open your stores on Shabbat? A rabbi made this up. Which rabbi? Doesn't say it in the Torah. In the Torah, it never says you can't open up your store. Which rabbi said you cannot open your store on Shabbat? His name was Isaiah. Yeshayahu HaNavi says not to do work on Shabbat. Which, by the way, the Chassam Sofer felt, if you open your store on Shabbat, now think about it, you can open your store and not break any one of the 39 laws. Right? You don't have to break any law. The Chassam Sofer said, if you open your store on Shabbat, you're breaking your rabbinic law. He said you are considered to be a Sabbath desecrator publicly. Why? Because he felt that there was... Okay, let me explain exactly what he felt. When do rabbis make up laws? And I'll say this especially true on Shabbat, but it's true in other areas as well. When do rabbis make up laws? When you have a... Who said they have nothing to do? Okay, that's it. We're making another one up, okay? Rabbis make up laws when there's a letter of the law and there's a spirit of the law and people are following the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law is being trampled upon. There's a letter of the law and there's a spirit of the law. When somebody keeps the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law is being trampled upon, that's where a rabbi will make up a law. That's where the rabbis, in the time of the Gemara, that's where they made up laws in order to protect the spirit of the law which is being trampled upon. So I think a wonderful example is exactly what Yeshayahu did. What did Isaiah do? He looks and he sees that people are being careful not to light a fire and they're being very careful not to carry, they're being careful, but they're keeping their stores open. So what does he say? You can't keep your stores open. Why not? Because you're not keeping Shabbat if your stores are open. But you could say, but technically I didn't break any Torah law. Yeah.
Aren't you breaking the law of
planting? Planting? Yeah. I'm not following.
When you're conducting business, you're planting ideas
but that's
in your head and in somebody else's
head.
So it doesn't have to be physical planting, it could be spiritual planting.
Right, so I'll tell you a secret. You're allowed to plant on Shabbat unless it's physically planting a seed in the ground. It's very specific because the next thing you tell me is that you're not allowed to have sex on Shabbat. Good. I had a feeling I'd quiet you.
Yeah. Is it the same thing with having a TV on Shabbat but having it on a timer?
Yeah, I think it's the same thing. I have very little doubt that had rabbis... From the time of the Gemara or the Mishnah, seen televisions, they would not have allowed it. They would not have allowed the timers either. Absolutely. I have little doubt about that. Now, again, you have to ask yourself, do you trust my intuition on this point? It could be you say, I don't trust your intuition on this point. By the way, then you can tell me another thing. If I don't put it on a timer, someone's going to put it on in my house. That becomes a different question. So, therefore, one has to be very careful answering publicly about such questions. But if you're asking me about my house, then they do not go on. And in my house, we would not have a timer put it on one way or the other. But I truly believe that each generation has to take a look and say, what is the spirit of Shabbat? And what kind of things would impinge on the spirit of Shabbat? And those are the try to things that we should try to stay away from. For example, what about leaving your computer on where the news will be updated? The screen, but the news will be updated. It's very hard for me to figure out why that would be prohibited. Very honestly, I don't know why that would be prohibited. On the other hand, I do believe that could impinge upon the spirit of Shabbat. And therefore, I would advise not doing it. If there's a war going on, God forbid, and there's some reason you need to know that information, okay, that becomes a different question, a different situation. I'll say something else, which will probably amuse some of you and bother others of you. I think that a woman wearing a wig tramples upon the spirit of the law. I think it follows the letter of the law, but does not. I think it tramples upon the spirit of the law. Are there rabbis who disagree with me? Absolutely, there are rabbis who disagree with me. But if you'll ask me, is it better for a woman to wear a hat and cover her hair or to wear a wig? No question in my mind it's better to wear a hat. Why do rabbis allow wigs? Because otherwise they suspect there are women who wouldn't cover their heads at all. Okay? So again, could you disagree with me on this? By the way, at this point, am I a good rabbi or a bad rabbi now? What?
Conservative.
With a big C or a little C? On the other hand, do rabbis occasionally overuse this authority? Yes, yes. And over here, I want to go back and speak to my audience. I like this building. I like the people that are here. I like this community. How many years have I come out here? I didn't even have gray then. At least, right? Most of them are out by now. They had escaped, and they were on the way to Shanghai. And they were being. But by the way, it's very interesting how they survived. The Japanese actually called in they escaped during the Holocaust. They'd escaped the Holocaust, and they had gone that way. And it was interesting because the Japanese called in a number of the rabbis and said, "We understand the Germans want to kill all of your people. What have you done? Why do they hate you so much?" So there were three rabbis in the room. One of them spoke Japanese enough that he could communicate. The other two just spoke Yiddish. And the rabbis were not sure exactly what to say. I mean, they could say because they think that we killed Jews, but that has nothing to do with it. It's not a Christian attack. So what to say? So one of the rabbis, I believe it was Rav Shatzkis, I believe it was him, who later on became a Rebbe in YU, Rav Shatzkis leaned over to the rabbi and said, "Tell him this." He told him, and they said, "Okay, we understand, you can stay." So what did he say? He said, "Because they consider the Jews who come from the Middle East, they consider us Asians." That was the answer that he gave. They consider us Asians, they don't like Asians, and that's the reason why they have this attitude towards us. That's it. They said, "Okay, you're welcome, you can stay as long as you need to stay." I'm serious, that's... Correct. But I don't think they ultimately trusted one another. So you, in this community, like to call yourselves a Baal Tshuva community. Is this correct? I don't like it.
We're Orthodox.
You're Orthodox. You're not Baal Tshuvas. Just get rid of that word. In order to be a Baal Tshuva, you need to be a sinner. Right? How many of you are sinners? Okay, don't raise your hand again. It could... In order to be a Baal Tshuva, it means you're a sinner, and now you're no longer a sinner. Most people, as I talked about that girl's parents, nice conservative Jews, this is what they did, this is what they thought. They were following what they thought was proper. People go from being uneducated to educated, and they change practice. Okay, that's fine. I'd actually use a different term. I made this up. I should have coined this long ago, but you can borrow it. I would call you nouveau frum. Sounds much better, okay? Nouveau frum. It sounds much better. Anyway, within the last week, I received two different phone calls from people who are nouveau frum, both of them asking me questions having to do with parenting, with kids, and one was a very serious situation, the other was lesser so, and both of them, after I gave them advice, I said, "I have a question for you." The first one, I hung up the phone, and I called them back. And I said, "I have a question for you." He says, "What's the question?" I said, "Before you became nouveau frum, would you have known what to do in this situation?" And he thinks, and he says, "Yes." So I said, "Why becoming religious, why did it make you so stupid?" What happened? You're an intelligent person. Why do you not know what to do? But it's interesting because he lost his confidence. Another couple, again, and I asked them. This time, I'd already practiced it earlier in the week. And I sat with them, and I went through the issue, and I said, okay, now, make believe you're not religious at all. The same question comes up. How would you handle it? So they tell me. I said, so why the fact that you're religious, why could you not figure that out on your own just now? So one is you're asking the rabbis the wrong questions. And when you ask the wrong questions, then rabbis think that they need to give you an answer. And then they start thinking, well, why is he asking me this? Okay, I'm going to have to find a reason to show how smart I am and to show how strict this really is. Think sometimes before you ask questions. Not every question needs to be asked. Certain things, yes? You like that. You like that, don't you? I know. And therefore, what I would suggest is if you don't have the confidence, think it through anyway and say, what do I think is the right thing over here? And then call your rabbi up and say, this is the situation. This is what I'm thinking about. Do you agree with me? Which is very different from asking a question. But I'm saying you need to do that process as well. Not every single situation is really necessarily a halakhic question. And not everything that comes up has to be asked of the rabbis. And I agree with you. I agree with you. There are some things that people ask they shouldn't be asking. There's some things that they should be asking that they're not asking. I agree.
That we should be,
I don't know who's telling you this.
She's saying that the Jewish culture lends itself to constantly approach rabbis.
Okay, so I'm questioning who's doing this. I don't know why.
Well, that's part of the reason why the question comes in. The rabbis bring Judaism. The rabbis are basically telling you, now that you're religious, you don't know anything, and now you need to ask rabbis everything. So that would be an example of rabbis bringing Judaism.
Okay, I will tend to agree with you. I think that we are encouraging people to ask in situations that a lot of, you know, common sense can go a long way. And again, if before you were religious, you looked at it one way, now you're religious, you think it's the same thing, so then say. I mean, again, that's a very different conversation than asking something which a person should know. Yes. That is your wife, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just... Okay, so this is a problem. And by the way, the reason they don't want men and women sitting with each other during a class is because they don't want men and women sleeping together. That's the... Anyway. I'll explain that to you later. Look, I don't live in this country. I don't live in this community. I get to speak here every couple of years, say obscene things, and they won't invite me back for a couple of years. But my personal feeling on this is that as far as weddings go, first of all, my wife and I, if we're invited to a wedding, which is separate seating, and if we have to go for whatever reason, more often than not, I don't have to go. But if I have to go for whatever reason, we'll go, say mazel tov, stay for the chuppah, and then go out for dinner. It costs me twice. Every time that there is, I'm saying that's what we do. We don't do that. Second point, I think it's obscene that they don't allow young people who are single to sit next to one another. I'm not talking about dancing. Dancing, have a mechitza, have separate buildings. But I think that by the wedding itself, I think it's a wonderful thing if single people sit next to one another. Because we don't let them sit next to one another. And then we say, now, why is there a shidduch crisis going on? Well, you know why? Because they don't get to meet one another. That's why there's a shidduch crisis going on. Which means that by a wedding, when the girl is dressed up and when the guy is dressed up, which, again, is not all that simple. I mean, take a look at some of the guys. Then this is a wonderful time to let them sit next to one another and without pressure to meet. And you know what? What's the worst thing that's going to happen? Someone's going to say, you know, that girl, who knows her? I'm interested. Okay, so it's great. I think that we can average 2 or 3 shidduchim a wedding. Per wedding, we can average 2 or 3 shidduchim if we were doing this. So I would go so far as to say the opposite is that I would not want to perform a wedding which had separate seating. Okay, what am I now? Which conservative, not conservative, big C, little C? Now you don't even know what to do with me. And again, I'll say it again, I think it's absolutely terrible. And then we create problems, then we try to look for solutions for problems that we've created. Point taken? Look, there's a problem of rabbis overextending their authority, of claiming that certain things is halacha when it really is not necessarily halacha. I don't know how much that happens over here. And again, this is really my ignorance. I've lived in Israel for the past 26 years. I've lived there the last 29 of 32 years. So I'm really not part of this community. Actually, I was never part of this community, but I'm not part of the American community that much. In Israel, in the last couple of weeks, there was a letter that went out, signed by 50 rabbis, saying that one is not permitted to rent or sell apartments to Arabs. Actually, it said non-Jews. It didn't say Arabs in it. It said non-Jews in it. I'll tell you a couple things about this. One, as soon as the letter came out, I had not seen it. I was by a Hanukkah party by my parents, and my sister-in-law's son said to me, so are you going to write a letter against them? I had no idea what he was talking about. I said, write a letter against whom? He goes, against these rabbis. I said, what did they say? So he told me, so I said, I'm not going to write a letter against them for a very simple reason. No one's going to care if I write a letter against them. Like, so what will they accomplish? He goes, well, tell them that they're absolutely wrong. I said, but I didn't. Again, I hadn't read it yet. I said, I'm not convinced they're absolutely wrong. It could be their position is justifiable, which is good. Because when you're young, then it's either black or white. This is right or that is right. But in the next couple of weeks, I actually got to see the letter. And I gave a class, and you can actually find this class on my website. And the letter said that it's against Jewish law. Exactly like I said, it's to rent or sell houses to non-Jews. And it quoted some sources on it. So I can tell you right now that the sources that they quoted were absolutely not correct. I can tell you furthermore that it was highly debatable, and not only was it highly debatable, that if we would have debated, they would have lost. I can also say that the 50 rabbis who signed this are very, very reputable people, and people that I would like to believe are far more knowledgeable than I am. So now we have a little bit of a problem. So it could be I'm totally wrong in my analysis, but it happens to be that I'm not. It could be that these guys never saw the letter that they signed, and they just heard the general thing, and therefore they decided to sign it, which means it could be they were signing it as a social problem of Arabs moving into Jewish neighborhoods, and they were signing against the social problem. But somebody, when they wrote this letter, decided to make it sound, this is what Jewish law says. So at that point, I decided to come out against it. And it could be that I'm very silly. Last Shabbos, I spoke about it in my shul. And on the way to the shir, I said to my wife that there was a poll that 40% of Israelis were in favor of the letter. And I assume among religious people, I said, what do you think? I said to my wife, I had a number in my head. I said, what percentage of people in the shir that I'm about to give do you think are in favor of it? So she said 80%. So I agreed. I also thought it would be around 80%. I said, I'm going to speak about it anyway. I'm going to go through the sources, source by source by source, and show them all. I said, I'm not going to speak about pragmatics, and I'm not going to speak about how to do PR, but I will speak about the halacha, is this halacha or not? And by the way, let's realize something. If you say that you can't, it's a Torah law that you can't rent an apartment to somebody who's not Jewish, that means that they have to check the religion of every person before they rent it. I mean, one of the big problems in Israel today is what do you do with 250,000 Russian Jews who may not be Jewish? And by the way, this is a huge problem. It is such a huge problem that the average rabbi not only doesn't know what to do with it, is not equipped to deal with it, for a very simple reason. We conducted ourselves in a certain way when we lived in exile. We lived in exile, you have a little town, or a little shtibel, and I don't care if the little town is in Syria, in Persia, is in Poland, is in Hungary. We had little towns, and you conduct yourself as a community in one way. But what happens when you become big, when you become a nation? There are national issues going on which are not simple, and they're not simply solved, and they're not going to go away, which means either we're going to have 250,000 Russians who are not Jewish today, which will mean 500,000 in the next generation or more, or we have to find some way of solving this problem. And again, I'm not at this point saying we need to cut any corners. I'm not saying that. I'm saying there's a problem that needs to be solved. But if you say you can't rent any apartment to somebody who's not Jewish, you can't rent to any of them either. But that wasn't their point. The point is they wanted to keep Arabs out. But what's the problem over here? The problem is they used halacha. Look, when I was in high school, and I went to a very religious high school, I went to one of these high schools that you had to wear a hat during davening. And I still resent it. And the kids weren't wearing their hats. Or literally, they would take their black hats, fold them up, and put it in their pockets afterwards when they would go home. Literally. So I was in ninth grade, and the Rebbe gets up and says, you have to wear your hat, and it's halacha, and it's this, and it's that. And then he says the following. John F. Kennedy was killed because he didn't wear a hat. I walked out of the room, and my brother saw me. My brother's a very big rabbi today, and he sees a look on my face, and he says, what happened? I told him. So my brother said, we better let the Warren Commission know about this. This was the one place they didn't investigate. Rabbis need to be careful. Rabbis need to be clear. We don't need to exaggerate. We need to say certain things, this is law, and we need to say certain things, this is my advice. We need to say certain things are good public policy, and they should get involved in public policy. But you have to be careful when you're a rabbi and speak about public policy and say, based upon my Torah knowledge, this is my opinion. But it doesn't mean that based on my Torah knowledge, this is law. And rabbis have a hard time drawing a line between those things. Because they tend to believe that if they're rabbis, they learned a lot, so whatever they're saying has to be law. So I'm saying we have a problem with that. Yes?
You pick a lot of cases and you analyze them. God bless you. I think you're a great rabbi.
Amen. I think we should stop now.
I wish we had 100 of you, because I think...
The problem is you have 1,000 of me. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think yeah. But the problem, to me, it seems that the standard of becoming a rabbi is so low that you have people that don't have the intellectual capability, that don't have the characteristics and the personality traits that you need to even before you even start studying Torah, and they become rabbis. And I've seen it firsthand. I've studied at a yeshiva a very short amount of time, but in that short amount of time, I've seen people treat each other with disrespect, not have the midot necessary to study Torah, and they're studying Torah. Forget about the fact that half the things they're studying they might not understand, and they're just not equipped intellectually. And we mentioned in the beginning of this lecture, people make mistakes, and that's very true. But some people make much more mistakes than other people.
Okay.
And those people should be not allowed to become a rabbi.
Okay. You make a good point, but the word rabbi today is almost meaningless. The title itself is almost meaningless. There's something else which is far more significant than a rabbi, and that's something you don't go to school for. I don't know exactly how it happens, but it's interesting. And that's called a posek. A posek, a decider of Jewish law. Which means, what do most rabbis do? They'll open up a book and say, oh, I found this in a book, and this is what it says. So what is his decision going to be based on? Which book he looked into? Here's another topic I did with my students, and I'll come back to your point in a second. Another topic I did with my students is I posed the following question. What is more binding? What your parents did in terms of halacha, Jewish practice, or what it says in a book? And they were arguing back and forth. After they argued literally for 15 minutes, I said, can I give you my opinion? So they said, yeah, what do you think? I said, it depends who your parents are, and it depends which book you're looking into. And those are two very important variables. Because not everything which says in a book just because it says in a book. You know, listen, you know why I wrote my first book? Someone said, where do you get that from? So I said, okay, it says it in a book. Okay? The fact that it says in a book, so what? And by the way, in terms of halacha, the English books are worse than the Hebrew books. The English books all have to be strict. Don't ask me why. But it won't make a difference anymore. And this is a whole other topic. The English books in halacha are always stricter than the Hebrew books are. Unless they have Hebrew in the footnotes. And then the footnotes will say, oh, but we really our leniency is over here and over there. I feel bad for all of you who may have to learn halacha, Jewish law, from English books. English books are absolutely terrible. I wrote an article which nobody read. I think I'm the only one who read it. I wrote an article a number of months ago, which was actually published in a book someplace, and the article is something about halacha in the computer age. And one of the points that I made was by writing all these books in English, which are all strict, is ultimately not going to make a difference because right now people are still looking in books, but it's already going to stop. Very soon it's going to stop. People will start looking for their halacha answers on Google. Why not? You look for everything else on Google. Why shouldn't you look up a halacha on Google? And when you look it up on Google, what are you going to find? Well, that depends on who put something up on the net. And the net, with all of its anonymity, you can write all kinds of things that you want to. So what ends up happening is you have people writing things in English, which are extreme, and then you have this counter movement taking place where people are writing things which are even more extreme, which they'll find in English, and then the average person, I don't know what you're going to end up doing. So it's interesting, but I want to get back to your point about a rabbi. A rabbi today may go through that kind of training to become a guy who's going to sit and watch the chickens being shechted, or the mashkiach in a store, or somebody who's going to be teaching fourth grade, which, by the way, is a very big problem, or somebody who's going to be ending up maybe being a pulpit rabbi, or all kinds of other things. It doesn't mean that every rabbi should be deciding Jewish law. In the olden days, a person who was a rabbi who was somebody who was deciding Jewish law, and I will tell you right now that the vast majority of rabbis are not capable of deciding Jewish law. They're not capable of it. If they are capable, and I'll qualify myself, then they're capable of deciding things which are written clearly in books. But new situations that come up, which are gray area, most rabbis are not capable of doing this. I would like to believe that most rabbis know that they're not capable of doing this, and in those cases, they defer to somebody who is more knowledgeable, and as I said, that person is a posek. It is possible that when you're in yeshiva and you see a whole bunch of guys studying for rabbinic, could be that some of the best guys and some of the worst guys, some of the guys who could have gone to any law school in the country and some guys who couldn't get into any law school, and that's why they're sitting there. Again, that's possible in any given yeshiva. On the other hand, when you look at the people who become poskim, who communities accept that these guys rule on Jewish law, generally those guys are on a different level. Unfortunately, and I agree with you, that there may not be as many of those people out there as we need.
And the vast majority of the population doesn't know the difference.
Correct. Correct, correct. Now, did I want to get to some Torah here today? Are you guys already tired? I've already been talking too much. I was going to teach some Torah, yeah.
The fact that those rabbis passed out the letter and they passed out the halacha, how can we trust them to make any more rulings? And you're saying these are very credible rabbis.
What I'm telling you is that every person needs a rabbi. The rabbi that you need is somebody who should be objective and knowledgeable and knows you and knows your situation and understands your situation. I will, if you haven't heard me say it yet, I will say it clearly. I give different answers to the same questions to different people. Okay? In case you suspected that rabbis do this, I admit it. I do it. Why? Because if a different person asks the same question, it's not the same question. When a rabbi hears a question, the first thing is just like your doctor. Your doctor has to do a diagnosis. He hears symptoms, but he has to do a diagnosis. You don't trust the patient to do the diagnosis. The patient tells you what's bothering them. And sometimes people will trust the patient to do the diagnosis. That's a problem right there. There's a very famous story that I heard from Rabbi Soloveitchik about his grandfather, Reb Chaim. That Reb Chaim, the day or two before Passover, a man comes into his office and says, Rabbi, are you allowed to use milk for the 4 cups of wine? And he says, no, you can't use milk, you need to use wine. And he reaches into his pocket and gives him the equivalent of $200. And he walks out of the room. There was a student sitting there watching. He says, Rabbi, I understood what you did. The guy asks if he can use milk. So obviously the guy's got a cow and he's got access to milk, but doesn't have wine, so he gave him money for wine. But why do you give him so much money? The bottle of wine, $10, $20, $40, why do you give him so much? So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, because if he's asking, can you use milk for the four cups, it means he doesn't have any meat either. So the job of a rabbi is to do the proper diagnosis and to help solve the problem. Right? That's the rabbi that you wanted, right? I want to do one small passage from the Gemara, and then I'm going to let you go home. This passage, I'm in the middle of writing. I'm writing another book, not the book that you spoke about. I'm writing another book, which is, as of right now, unnamed. If you want, we can vote on the name.
It's
going to
be Elevation.
So the original, the working title is actually Elevations, to finish my E-trilogy with after the other two. But it could be that the name of the book will end up being The Crowns and the Letters, which probably the graphic artist will like much more. There's a very famous story that rabbis were arguing, Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim were arguing, and Rabbi Eliezer says, I'll bring you every proof in the world. He brings them, the rabbis ignore him. At the end, he starts to do all kinds of signs and wonders and miracles. He says, if I'm right, the tree will prove it. The tree jumps up in the air, and they say, that's irrelevant. He says, if I'm right, the stream will prove it, and the stream starts to go backwards. They say, that's irrelevant. He said, if I'm right, the walls of the Beit Midrash will prove it, and the walls start to fall down. They say, that's irrelevant. He says, if I'm right, it will be proven from heaven, and a voice comes out of heaven and says, what is your problem with Eliezer? The law is like him and everything that he says. And Rabbi Yeshua stands on his feet and says, Lo b'shamayim hi, Torah is not in heaven. Which basically, you have a rabbi standing up and saying to God, mind your own business. We're talking Torah here. This has nothing to do with you. And I think that story encapsulates our problem. We want to believe the Torah is divine. On the other hand, God gives it to us. And we tell God, mind your own business. So there's many, many elements to this story. And in the article that I just now wrote, 3/4 of the way finished, I explain every step of the way, including why the water and why the tree and why every step. But you're not getting all that now. For that, you'll have to buy the book. Or wait for the movie to come out. It's this one point of saying to God, you know, mind your own business. Now, first of all, it's a little more complicated. Because the Gemara then says, what does it mean, you know, it's not in heaven? So it continues and says, because God gave us the Torah and says, follow the majority. Which right then we have a problem. God says the law is like him, and God said to follow the majority. So right now we already have a more complex issue. What's the issue? Is truth based upon the substance of what God said, or is truth based upon the procedure that God told us to follow? Both of this came from God. The procedure comes from God, and the substance comes from God. So if anything, I have a struggle between the two. The Sefer HaChinuch, while not discussing this Gemara specifically, says that the reason we'll follow the majority is that it's better to suffer making a mistake occasionally than to have anarchy. It says that's a worthwhile trade-off. Water. Plain water. You hear? Better to suffer occasional mistakes, and that's what God wants. When God said follow the majority, is God aware that occasionally the majority could be wrong? Think about it. The majority of people on this planet have been wrong more often than been right about important things. We make lots of mistakes. God says follow the majority. So Sefer HaChinuch says why? Better to suffer an occasional mistake than and not to have anarchy. The Vilna Gaon gave, in what my mind is, a fascinating analysis. And in order to explain this, thank you, he goes back to a beautiful teaching about creation. It's a midrash that says that when God was about to create the world, create Adam, he summons in the angels, group by group. Some say create, some say don't create. The Gemara said, Chesed said, create. Which, by the way, if you want to justify your existence on this earth, you do Chesed. Very, very simple. There's a passage that should be better known. It's in the book of Ezra. It says that after many years, when the Jews were in exile, they came back and they started to read the Torah, and they realized it was Rosh Hashanah, and the people started to cry, and they were scared, and so on. And you know what the Navi tells them to do? Go ahead, be happy, be joyful, and give gifts to one another. Rosh Hashanah. If I were to ask you, which day does the prophet say to give gifts to one another, all of you would have told me, oh, that's Purim. Except Purim is not really a prophet. Here, when to give gifts, it says Rosh Hashanah. So why in the world give gifts on Rosh Hashanah? So I think it's this Medrash. Give gifts on Rosh Hashanah. Well, this Medrash is explaining that idea. Why give gifts? Because as human beings, we are fallible. We make mistakes. We do terrible things. But you know what we're capable of doing? We're capable of doing chesed. We're capable of doing kindness. So if we want to justify our existence, we need to dedicate ourselves to do kindness for others. Ultimately, God creating us is an act of kindness. We need to do kindness for others. But after kindness says create, truth says don't create, because man is full of lies. I'm going to spare you the rest of the passage. There's a further debate between justice, peace, whether to create or not. As all of the traits are arguing, it says that God takes truth, throws it to the ground, says, stop arguing, the world is already created. The Vilna Gaon said that there is an aspect of truth which exists in heaven. If we are so concerned of living our lives based on that level of truth, we should know we never should have been created. Creation necessitates truth taking a beating. We're in the image of God. That sounds like a joke. God is perfect, we're so imperfect. What kind of image is this? So to allow man to be created, God takes truth and throws it to the ground, and now man can be created. By the way, I think that when the Jewish people sinned with a golden calf, Moshe comes down the mountain and he takes the Torah and throws it to the ground, takes the Ten Tablets, throws the Ten Commandments, throws it to the ground. I think he was doing the exact same thing. He's saying to God, you created man who you knew were going to make mistakes by taking truth and throwing it to the ground. Moshe said, I'm doing the exact same thing, and now forgive them. Because you know that that's what we are. We make mistakes. But the Vilna Gaon now explains, he didn't say that part, I said that part. But the Vilna Gaon now continued and explains that it's true that up in the recesses of heaven, God is saying the law is like Rabbi Eliezer, and our response is it doesn't make a difference because we don't live our lives based upon the highest levels of heaven. We base our lives on what we think is right. God gave us a law, God gave us a Torah, God gave us principles, God gave us intellect, and God said, you're my partner. I accept you as my partner. You're the junior partner in this corporation. You're in charge of marketing. You're in charge of sales. You're in charge in seeing that the product really makes it. That means that we're going to have a really serious human element to this. But God chose us as his partner. Will we make mistakes? Yes, we'll make mistakes. Should we be concerned? But up in heaven there's another truth? It's real interesting, but the Vilna Gaon says, but it doesn't make a difference. Because if you really want to live your life on that truth, we never should have come onto this planet to begin with.
Isn't the relationship that we're supposed to have with the cultural pool an intimate relationship more than a business relationship?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Without any question about it. But I'm just pointing out a very simple fact, which I said in the beginning. I make mistakes, you make mistakes, rabbis make mistakes, we all make mistakes. On the other hand, God entrusted us, try to go about and do your best. The community needs to stand behind rabbis and strengthen them and give them, I would say, allow them to do what they believe is right. Sometimes rabbis are afraid. Sometimes rabbis are also looking and polling people. I told you, I polled before I went in, I said 80% will be against me, but it didn't stop me at all. They don't pay me anything, by the way, so it doesn't make a difference. I can get up and say what I want. But yeah, go ahead. My advice for you is, if you want to become a rabbi for the kavod, don't do it. That's my personal advice.
That creates the standard.
We should be honoring all kinds of people. You know, how many of us go, let's say, to a wedding, and somebody serves us something, but we just expect it. You don't even pay attention to it. Do you say thank you every time somebody helps you? You should. I'm saying human beings deserve our thanks. Human beings deserve our gratitude. We need to be the kinds of people that have an incredible sense of gratitude for everybody who does things for us. Rabbis do things for us as well. And we certainly honor their knowledge, honor them when they teach us without any question. But on the other hand, we need to honor others as well. Yeah.
Surgery, you'll go and you'll find the best surgeon and you'll find the right person and the specialist, no problem. We have to use that same expertise to find a rabbi.
I agree with you completely. I was intimating that, yes.
Is there an ideal in the Jewish world that every single Jew should be knowledgeable to make their own decisions? They don't need a rabbi?
There's an ideal that every person should be as knowledgeable as possible. There are certainly mystical teachings that teach about this in terms of connecting to God, connecting to Mount Sinai, that every single person was there and had they call it a tzinor, a pathway directly to God. But on the other hand, the Torah also speaks about having the elders. And the elders are the ones when, again, it could be on a pragmatic level, that we can't make decisions, we need the elders to make a decision. But as we saw, but on the other hand, the Torah has a whole passage, and what happens when the elders are wrong? A special offering is there when the elders all make a mistake. And that also happens. Judaism does not believe in papal infallacy. We make mistakes. What we need to know, and I'm going to conclude, what we need to do as a community is invest in rabbis, and I want to go back to your point. We need to go out and get the guys who would have been the top guys in law school or medical school and other schools. Not that I'm saying those vocations are bad, they're great. We need to get the best minds and say, we are investing in you because we want you to be in this community. In the Syrian community in New York, I have a friend who's a rabbi there. He told me he was going to business school. He had gone to yeshiva earlier. They handpicked him and said, we know how much you're going to make your first year out of school. We know how much you'll make your second year out of school. We're signing you now for a five-year contract. We're going to match that salary, and you're going to become a rabbi in our community. Okay, so how many communities are willing to say, we're going to put the money up, and we want to try to raise rabbis? I think you need the same thing to do in terms of poskim. We need to be raising people who are on a much, much higher level in terms of expertise in Jewish law. But the community has to say, you know, step up. You can't pay the salaries that you're paying and saying, but I want excellence. It's not going to happen. Yeah. His wife had the shop, and he never had smicha. He wasn't really a rabbi. Okay, but I'm saying, but it's interesting. The Chafetz Chaim never had smicha. He was not really a rabbi. But what difference did that make? Anyway, I hope that we have solved more problems than I've caused tonight. I hope that the answer is the rabbis have not ruined Judaism, but Judaism is not ruined. Judaism is alive and it's vibrant, and we have wonderful rabbis. We have wonderful leaders. But it's our business to make them even more wonderful and to make the religion even more vibrant. Thank you very much.